In this hour of Focus 580, this is the question that we'll be discussing. What happens when multinational corporations decide that the use of armed force is just business by other means? That is the central question of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is Making a Killing: How Corporations Use Armed Force to Do Business. It's a book that's published by the Lions Press, and we'll be talking in this hour with the author of the book, Canadian journalist Madeleine Drohan. She presents a number of case studies in this book, all of them drawn from Africa, looking at companies that have linked up with mercenaries, warlords, private militias in order to make a profit. She does explain in the book that she could also have included accounts of companies that have used armed force elsewhere in the world, including the former Soviet Union, Latin America, and Asia. This is a book that was first published in 2003 by Random House of Canada, and then in 2004 by the Lions Press in the United States. It won the Ottawa Book Award and was shortlisted for the National Business Book of the Year Award in 2004. She spends as much of her time as she can conducting journalism workshops for media in Africa and Southeast Asia with a special focus on business and investigative journalism, and she's just wrapped up a term as a journalist in residence at Carleton University. She lives in Ottawa, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the internet and you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Drohan, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. You apparently started becoming interested in this subject when you were in London at a time you were the European correspondent for the Globe and Mail. And they apparently asked you to look into a company, a Canadian company, ostensibly a Canadian company, because there had been stories in the press in Britain connecting that company to a group of mercenaries from South Africa. So you, apparently, you and some other reporters went there to try to check out the situation. This is a company called Diamond Works. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about what you found.
Yeah, that's right. And I should start off by saying that my background was business and economics journalist. So the whole idea that companies would somehow be linked up with mercenaries took me a bit by surprise. But we looked into this, and you're right, the company was Diamond Works, and its really only asset at the time was a diamond mine in Sierra Leone. And Sierra Leone was in the midst of a civil war at the time, so the company needed to do something about its security. But it went a bit deeper than that. They were linked up with this group of South African mercenaries called Executive Outcomes. And I don't know if that name will be familiar to your listeners. They certainly received a lot of publicity for a few years before they broke up. But what we found out that the connection was the main shareholder in Diamond Works would introduce Executive Outcomes to governments that needed their help, you know, governments that were facing a rebel movement or, you know, some sort of civil unrest. And they would be hired. And usually what they would do was go in and clear the rebels out of wherever the resources were. And this happened in Sierra Leone, and it also happened in Angola later. In Sierra Leone, it was diamonds. And once they were cleared out of that area, once the rebels were cleared out by the mercenaries, then one of the companies that this Mr. Buckingham had shares in would get a concession for diamonds or for oil and that. And that's basically how that worked. And he built, you know, the use of armed force into his business plan.
And there, we can talk about some of the specific examples that you look at in the book, and some of them do go back into history some way, but there certainly are contemporary examples. And I guess what all of these things, all of these stories have in common is that we're talking about a place where there is some very valuable natural resource, where the government of this place is weak, or maybe there's not much of a government there at all. There is a conflict going on at the time, which in one sense might make companies reluctant to go in there at all, but that also helps to reduce competition for those who decide that they can. And it seems that there are a number of cases, and you found them, and I'm sure that there are cases elsewhere in the world, where all of these conditions seem to apply.
Absolutely. And I can think of one right off the top of my head that's pretty dominant right now, and that would be Iraq. No, we don't know what's going on in the Iraqi oil fields right now because journalists are not free to go there at the moment, or rather it would be too dangerous to go there. But certainly all of these conditions that you've just listed off apply to Iraq as well. Attractive resource, weak, unstable government. Companies, if they go there, they have to take security into their own hands. And apparently in Iraq, I think there's some estimates that were put out by the Brookings Institution that there's something like 10,000 private military contractors that are working there right now. Certainly some of them would be in the oil fields.
Well, you explain in the beginning of the book this how you were first introduced to thinking about this. And as you said, as a journalist, your experience had been in doing business and economic stories. And I think at some point you say it never even would have occurred to you that a company would in a deliberate way have armed force as part of their business plan. And once you investigated this first particular case of this company, then you said to yourself, well, I wonder how many other cases there are. Is this an exception or are there other examples? And that's when you started looking back a little bit in time and looking elsewhere around Africa, and you came up with the cases that are in the book in Making a Killing. Perhaps we could talk a little bit, or you could talk a little bit about some of the older cases. And it seemed that one of the things that has changed over time is that if you go back and you look at for example, as you do, you look at the Congo when it was the personal property of Leopold II. He was the only man, I think, ever in history to have his own personal colony. Or also the case of South Africa. There was a time when companies, it wasn't just that they were doing business with somebody who did business with mercenaries. They had their own armies. They cut the middleman out of it, and they actually had their own personal armed forces.
Yeah, it was certainly more acceptable 100 years ago to have a corporate army, you know, than it is today. But the end result is the same. But I did, you're right, after I had done some work on Diamond Works and we had published some stories about that, and plus another of the examples in the book, which was Saxena, a banker who's actually under house arrest in Canada, but he funded a mercenary counter coup in Sierra Leone. But those two I had covered for the Globe and Mail. And then I was fortunate, I got a Reuters fellowship at Oxford, which is basically gives journalists a year to research whatever they want. And I thought, I'd like to go back and take a look at, you know, whether or not this is something that's brand new, you know, the use of mercenaries by corporations, because again, you know, I was starting from scratch here. And what I basically was researching was the modern history of this. I'm sure that you could probably go back even further and find examples, but I wanted to look at, say, the last 100 years. So I did start with Cecil Rhodes, who most people only know through the Rhodes Scholarship now, you know, and it's seen as sort of a badge of honor to have a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford, but very few people ask, well, how did he get that money? And one of the ways he got the money was by forming the British South Africa Company, which had its own private army, the British South Africa Company Army. And they basically went up through Southern Africa and captured territory on behalf of the company. It was a corporate territory, and it was run for about 2 decades by the corporation for corporate profits. But it was in the course of that sort of, you know, seizure of territory, they did all sorts of horrible things. And again, this was considered acceptable at the time because Rhodes was not just working for a corporation, but supposedly expanding the empire. But once I sort of had documented that, then I moved forward in time. And as you said, I looked at King Leopold in the Congo because he had rubber companies. I looked at De Beers in Sierra Leone. They'd actually hired the former head of Britain's MI5 to set up a security organization for them in Africa, and that organization hired mercenaries in Sierra Leone. We're talking now in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I move forward, and I hit some companies that will be familiar to your listeners, like Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria, and Talisman, which was a Canadian oil company that was active in the Sudan. It pulled out about a year ago. What I saw was that while companies were using armed force all the way along, and people were dying, when I say using armed force, they were killing people. But in the beginning, it was a corporate army, and then they learned how to distance themselves. And so they ended up either teaming up with a national army, like in Nigeria or in Sudan, or contracting it out, hiring these private military companies that have become available, and having them do their work and keeping it at arm's distance.
Well, and also I think you find some fault in corporate boards and perhaps also in stockholders and companies for not paying enough attention to the methods that are employed by their companies. I guess that brings to mind my question: how easy or how difficult is that if a company is employing these kind of methods? How difficult would it be for the board of directors of the company to know that, or for stockholders to know that?
Well, it's relatively easy, I think, in most cases for the company to hide what they're doing if they're operating in a conflict zone where journalists aren't covering the incidents. I mean, there is certain amount of media coverage. There was certain amount of media coverage for almost every incident I looked at in the book, but it was fairly patchy. If we just take the board of directors for a start, I found that a lot of the time that the boards were basically ruled by management rather than the other way around. And in fact, many of the problems that I found in the end led to this within the companies are the same sort of problems that led to Enron and WorldCom. You know, there was a failure of corporate governance within the company. There was a lack of information between the management and the board. And I'll give you one example. There was a company in Canada called Ranger Oil that's now part of a much bigger company called Canadian Natural Resources. And they were in Angola, in the offshore oil fields in Angola. And at one point in the early 90s, their supply base on land was overrun by rebels. So they called in Executive Outcomes, these South African mercenaries, who retook the supply base, you know, in a bloody battle where people were killed. And I looked at the annual report for that year to see what Ranger said about it. And the only reference they had that even came close was they said, well, political conditions in Angola were unsettled. And I talked to a number of the men who were on the board of directors at the time. And they said to me, well, this never came up. We never discussed this. And then I asked the people who were in management at the time, well, you know, why wasn't it discussed? And they said, well, it wasn't material. So I draw from that and from another several other instances that, you know, disclosure by companies of what they're doing abroad is often very brief, to the point of almost being misleading. And so it's difficult for people, unless they're actually following the country and know the circumstances on the ground, to know what the company's up to.
I have several callers here, and we'll start to bring people into the conversation. I also would like to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Madeline Drohan. She's an award-winning journalist. She's covered business and politics in Canada, Europe, and Africa during a 25-year career. If you'd like to read more on this subject, we are talking here about a book titled Making a Killing, How Corporations Use Armed Force to Do Business. This is a book that was first published in Canada in 2003, and then last year by the Lions Press in the United States, so certainly you should be able to find it in the bookstore. It won the Ottawa Book Award and was shortlisted for the National Business Book of the Year Award for 2004. She makes her home in Canada, and she's talking with us by telephone, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some listeners here. First in Champaign, someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I've just finished reading a book called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim by a man named Mahmoud Mamdani. And in it, he argues that in the 1970s, U.S. foreign policy had to essentially go underground after the Vietnam War, resulting in what he calls the privatization and internationalization of military conflict. And in the 1970s, this occurred largely in southern Africa, in Mozambique and Angola. And I was wondering whether you could talk about whether these corporations, whether this was at one point at which these corporations came into play.
Well, I know there is one example in the book that I looked at, which was Tiny Roland, who was operating in Mozambique during the period that you're talking about. I'm not sure. He was British, so he wasn't American. I always got the sense from reading about these people, not just Tiny Roland, but others, that they had links to or connections with at high levels within their governments and within the security establishments. So people knew what they were doing, and I think to a certain extent they had to make sure that they were following policies that ultimately their government agreed with. Now, Tiny Roland in the end didn't really do that because he ended up both giving money to the government, the Frelimo government in Mozambique, and the Renamo rebels at the same time. He's one of the few corporate bosses I saw that was playing both sides of the fence. But say in another case, which was the Saxena, where a British mercenary group called Sandline went into Sierra Leone in the late 1990s, I don't know if you've heard of that. It was ended up being the subject of two parliamentary inquiries in the UK. And there was a lot that wasn't said at that inquiry, partly because there was a sense that people higher up might be being protected. But certainly the head of that mercenary group, his name was Tim Spicer, said that they had checked with the government and thought that they had the okay for that. You know, that they were sort of implicitly doing, carrying out government policy in Sierra Leone, which was the restoration of the president in exile. So I'm not sure if that directly answers your question.
Well, I have heard of Ken Spicer now that you mention it, but I guess my more general question, and maybe it's too big, is what's the relationship here? You know, what Mamdani talks about in his book is the relationship between the CIA and the drug trade used to finance these things. Most obviously in the Iran-Contra affair, and in the 1980s. But how do these private corporations, and then the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s? So, what is the relationship between these corporations and the CIA and the drug trade, if any, in these matters?
Well, to tell you the truth, in it didn't come up much in the cases I was looking at in Africa, and it wasn't so much the drug trade there either. If we were going to talk about sort of illicit resources, it was the diamond trade there, you know, where there were actually some triangular deals. And in fact, the one I'm talking about with Tim Spicer in Sierra Leone, it was a triangular deal where the businessman Saxena got diamond concessions. And he paid the government money that then they paid the mercenaries. So it was all a bit iffy. But the CIA didn't pop up in these cases, I have to tell you that.
And did any of these corporations pop up in the cases of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the 1980s?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the firms, Tony Buckingham with Ranger Oil, the one that I was talking about that were in Angola, he was actually going after some concessions in Pakistan as well. But I didn't follow that far enough down, drill down far enough to find out who was ultimately at the bottom of it. So I'm sorry to disappoint you on that
one.
I can't really elaborate.
All right. Okay.
Well, that I guess it does, in my mind, though, raise a general question just to sort of underscore this, and that is to the extent to which the companies that we're talking about, the companies that are using, again, to use your phrase, including armed force as part of their business plan, either having contracting with somebody for mercenaries, making a deal with the government where you say, well, we'll exploit the resources for you. You supply the muscle, which certainly happened. Whether in cases like that, these companies have some kind of political agenda or primarily are what we're talking about simply is their desire to make money.
Yeah, I haven't found with most of them that they have a political agenda. I would say that profits are at the bottom of it. I mean, that is their prime goal. But that said, they are aware of which way the political winds are blowing, and they make sure that they're not completely going against those winds as well. I looked at every single one of these cases, and because one of the questions that I wanted to answer was, why was it that governments who had the power to intervene didn't? And I'm not just talking about the company's home governments, but also the global powers at the time. And it was usually because what the company was doing fit some broader political objective. You know, going back as far as Rhodes in southern Africa, I mean, that was the time of empire building, and he was expanding the empire. It was empire building on the cheap because you got companies to do it. In De Beers in Sierra Leone in the 1950s, what they did, I mean, you know, they were killing diamond smugglers, but when they were questioned about it, they said, well, those diamonds were ending up behind the Iron Curtain and being used by the Russians for their H-bomb campaign. Now, that was the great era of anti-communism. And so, you know, I find that all of them, if they could dress up what they were doing in terms of some sort of acceptable rhetoric that fit with where the political winds were blowing, and that way they made sure that at least they weren't going to be getting grief from some of these global powers that could do something about it.
Well, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Eureka on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting program. I thought of two particular instances, and I guess I'm wondering how they would fit into your guess framework. One was in 1954, I believe the Arbenz government in Guatemala was overthrown, and I think the primary reason was the United Fruit Company, which controlled a good deal of the economy of Guatemala, which I believe was based on bananas, their land was threatened to be expropriated. And the other example I thought of was in 1952, I believe the Shah of Iran's government overthrew, I believe it was Mossadegh, who was threatening to nationalize oil companies in Iran.
Actually, those two examples fit perfectly, although in effect, you've answered the previous caller's question, so thank you for that.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't mean to, but I'm glad to have you.
Well, yeah, because I think in both of those cases, you really did see a government's political objectives come into play in a big way. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about the United Fruit Company example. I mean, I know something about it, but it seemed to me that basically did have the backing of the U.S. government. You know, it wasn't just the corporate. I think they even supplied some of the soldiers for that.
That's my memory of it. What I
yeah, remember. Yeah. And again, the other one, you know, in fighting off nationalization, again, that had the support of the global powers. They didn't want to see that happening. And so, yeah, those two, there's definitely the use of armed force there. But I would say they differ from some of my examples in that there's also that overriding political objective and a boost from behind the scenes by a major government.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, let's go on. We'll talk next with a caller here, line number 2, and I believe they're in Champaign County. Hello.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot there. That's when the government is acting on behalf of the corporations as opposed to our government, as opposed to some comprador government in Africa or somewhere else. I wanted to get your comments on the Barrick Gold Mining Company, which had Canadian company, but board of directors included George H.W. Bush and Adnan Khashoggi, who was bagman on the Iran-Contra deal. Mm-hmm. This had been somewhat publicized because there were libel cases against the Observer in London. You might have been there at the time, and Greg Palast has it in his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. But people were buried alive because by the Tanzanian military police, because Barrick Gold wanted to take over the mine, and it had been sort of for quite a few years had been used by local, you know, miners.
I know the case you're talking about. Although I think that happened before Barrick actually bought that particular mine. They're on the hook now because they own it. And there's been a great deal of controversy over that because this is a problem that comes up a lot in Africa. I was in the Democratic Republic of the Congo last year, and that's another place like Tanzania that's very rich in resources. But the people are incredibly poor. So what happens is they have what they call artisanal miners. You know, just anybody who has a shovel and a bucket goes out there and tries to mine. And, they're doing it so they can survive, basically. And you'll get a mining company that comes along and either buys the property or decides to enforce its ownership, and they force people off the land. Now, in the case of Tanzania, I think it was I don't know exactly which force it was that went in there to try to enforce it. And there was an unknown number of people who were killed in that incident. In the Congo, what's happening is they're calling in, some of the mining companies are calling in British mercenary groups to go in and basically clear the areas. And people die because of that. But you don't hear about that very much, again, because Congo has been at war for most of the last 5 years. There is sort of a fragile peace there now. But just to go back to Barrick Gold again, because they actually had gone into the Congo at one point, but they pulled out because they found that they couldn't do any work there because it was too insecure on the ground. And you have to be very careful what you say about these companies, too. I mean, my parents were very afraid when I was researching this book, you know, that I was traveling around Africa and talking to mercenaries and warlords, but what I actually feared even more was being sued for libel by one of the companies I was covering.
Well, the suits against the Observer were settled in favor of the Observer, and Barrick had to admit that they couldn't deny that this massacre was done. And if they didn't own it, they were negotiating for it at the time. That's something you can post-date, apparently. Yeah. Did you look also into the way Chevron in Nigeria and Ogoniland sort of had this cooperative basis where they would supply their helicopters to fly the Nigerian military around to crush whatever indigenous opposition to the really, I guess you probably went through there, it's sort of nightmarish landscape because of the oil exploitation that's going on there. And I guess I'll hang up because I think there's some other callers. Thank you.
Well, no, but thank you for that. I actually overflew the Chevron site in the Niger Delta. But what I looked into specifically was Royal Dutch Shell there, just because they had been there so long. But I understand most of the oil operations there are done in partnership with other companies, and many of their tactics are the same. And actually, Chevron has being the focus of quite a few protests, especially recently. But the case I looked at was just beside Ogoniland in another tribal area, and it was at a village called Umakem, where some protesters went out to protest at the Shell installation. And in actual fact, they were protesting because the roads were in terrible shape, and they thought if they went and protested at the Shell operation that Shell might be inclined to do something about the roads. But what Shell did was they actually called a unit of the Nigerian military known as the Mobile Police. That's their official name, but the locals call them the Kill and Go, because they have a reputation for coming in and sort of shooting first and asking questions later. And what they did in Umakem was they went in and they just opened fire, and nobody actually knows how many people died. Anywhere between 25 and 80 people were killed. And the reason that they don't know is that the police chopped up their bodies and threw them in the river afterwards. Now, to give Nigeria its due, they did hold an inquiry into this, and basically, you know, said that the Mobile Police had acted improperly, but I don't believe anyone was ever punished for it. And it just shows you the danger of companies that go into areas that are very unsettled, that just their very presence there and their ties with the repressive rulers can lead to massacres like this.
And that's just another example of how this strategy perhaps has evolved over time from companies having their own armies to employing somebody who can go out and hire mercenaries to making a deal with a repressive government where they say, look, you've got this great resource here. We can go in there and develop it. We can make money. You can make money. And then relying on that government to supply any military force that might be needed.
Yeah, and I find, too, with companies, when they're talking to their shareholders back here and putting out information, they tend to be a bit misleading because they keep talking about sovereign governments and rules of law and that. And it sort of conjures up the images in our minds of our own governments, you know, which we rely on to keep the peace and we assume will act in a certain way. But, you know, a government here is not the same necessarily as a government in some of these African countries. You know, they don't have necessarily the best, you know, they're not looking after for their people's best interests. Often some of them are lining their own pockets with the company revenue. So it's something that people have to look at when they're looking at corporate information, you know. Is that government that the company says it's, you know, linked up with legally, are they really the type of government that we're thinking of?
We'll talk with someone else here next in the nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, you mentioned a name earlier that struck a chord of memory to me. Several years ago, a great songsmith, Warren Zevon, who since passed away, had a song about Roland. Is that the same Roland?
No, it isn't. But I know that song. That's Roland the Thompson Gunner.
Yes.
Yeah, and actually he was writing about the mercenaries that were used in the Congo in the 1960s.
Oh, the same and sort of idea, though, right?
It was exactly the same idea. In that case, they were being paid by a Belgian company called Union Minière. And Union Minière had set up this huge copper empire in Katanga. And at the time of independence in 1960, Katanga wanted to, I should go back a bit. In 1960, when the Congo became independent, they elected Patrice Lumumba as their prime minister. And the United States thought that Lumumba was communist. So the government in Katanga, where Union Minière had their copper empire, decided that they were going to declare independence all on their own, and they hired mercenaries. And that's where that whole story of Roland the Thompson Gunner comes in. It was corporate money who was paying his bills.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are certainly welcome to call. Perhaps I should introduce again the guest for this hour, Focus 580, Madeline Drohan. She's an award-winning journalist who has covered business and politics in Canada, Europe, and Africa during a 25-year career. She, whenever possible, she conducts journalism workshops for media in Africa and Southeast Asia with a special focus on business and investigative journalism. She is author of the book Making a Killing, How Corporations Use Armed Force to Do Business. It was first published in 2003 in Canada, and then last year, 2004, published here in the United States by the Lions Press. And certainly you can head out to the bookstore if you're interested in reading the book. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have very quickly sketched over some examples of some of the companies that have done this. And I guess I also want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about Salim Saleh, the brother of the president of Uganda, Yoweri Museveni.
That's right. I ended the book with a chapter on him for a reason, and that was that these methods of using armed force up to that point had pretty much, corporate use of armed force had pretty much been by foreign companies, you know, that had gone into Africa. I looked at British and Canadian and Belgium and the multinationals like Shell, which you can never really tell where they're from. But Salim Saleh, he basically looked at those methods and decided that he would use them too. And I thought that was a very disturbing situation where now they were being used by Africans against Africans. I'm not saying that's worse or better, but it's a continuation of basically something that I think, you know, can't go unpunished. So Salim Saleh is the younger brother of the Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, and he combined service in the army, because he was very high up in the Ugandan army, with corporate interests. And what he did was, when the Ugandan army invaded the Congo in the late 1990s, Saleh went in there and basically set up a number of business deals that benefited various companies, including things like bringing rare timber out of the Congo, because it's a resource. We're always thinking in terms of oil or diamonds or gold, but timber is also a rare resource. But he also got into diamonds as well, and he was in with a very unsavory bunch of people. I mean, the Eastern Congo for the last 5 years has been run by a series of warlords, but you'll even get people in there, you know, that sort of draws in people from around the world. There was a Russian gunrunner who became involved at one point, and the Middle East came into that because some of the diamonds were going out through the Middle East and being smuggled. So I thought he was, you know, a good example of how this was being adopted by Africans. Now, the Ugandan government for a long time, first of all, they denied they were even in the Congo, and who was to say whether they were there or not, because it was too dangerous for most journalists to go in. But it ended up being confirmed that they were there. And then when his activities came to light, and it wasn't just Salim Saleh, there was a number of Ugandan businessmen who were in there making a profit. The president of Uganda was forced to actually set up a judicial inquiry to look into it. And people thought, oh, this is going to be a whitewash and that. Well, it was, but it wasn't. You know, they did actually point to a lot of people for making, you know, massive profits out of the war in the Congo. But not very many people have been punished, and certainly not Salim Saleh. I mean, people knew that his close connection with the president would probably shield him from the worst of it. But as far as I know, he's still operating.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that sometimes it can be difficult for corporate boards, for stockholders, for people who might have an interest in how these companies do their business, to find out exactly how these companies are doing their business. One thing that I'm interested in is your feelings about media, about journalists, about the media, and whether they're doing a good enough job on these stories, and particularly whether you think that the media in Europe, for example, or in Canada, are doing any better than those in the United States.
Well, I think when we talk about media, we have to sort of divide it a bit. I don't think that business journalists are doing a very good job of it. I think that they are often, and, you know, this is a generalization, so keep in mind there are some exceptions, but business journalists are very narrowly specialized, and they tend to look at things like, you know, is the price of the stock going up or down, and is the CEO making more money or less money this year? And they don't know a lot about things like human rights or conflict or, you know, any international issues often, unless they have some sort of financial impact on the company. So I'm always amazed to read these reports about company. We have one in Canada right now. It's called Ivanhoe Mines, and they're active in Burma. And, you know, U.S. companies have been told not to go to Burma. Canadian companies have been told not to go to Burma because the government has such an appalling human rights record. But if you read a story about Ivanhoe Mines in the Canadian newspapers, and in fact there was one there today, you know, they just sort of give blunt or very basic, you know, financial information. And I always think you should put at the bottom of it, you know, this company is now active in Burma, so that people know what sort of a company they're investing in when they buy shares in it. So business journalists, I would say, are very poor at doing this. But then you go over to the other side where there's, you know, foreign affairs correspondents and that. Well, they have a weakness on the other side in that they often cover wars and, you know, human rights abuses and atrocities and that. But they tend to do it from that side of the coin. You know, they'll focus on people's stories and that, and they won't highlight the corporate involvement in some of these conflicts. So it sort of falls between the cracks, between these specializations. In terms of sort of, you know, are Canadian journalists better or worse than American or British ones, I would say you can probably find, you know, good and bad ones in each country. Certainly there's been a lot of good reports come out of the States on these companies. In fact, Harper's Magazine years ago wrote an excellent story about executive outcomes and just how they were operating in Sierra Leone. So, but I'd say in general, what's missing is people don't connect the dots often enough between, you know, the war story, the political story, the personal story, and the corporate story.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I printed that late, so I don't know if you already covered this or not, but did you cover any of the historical past in the U.S. of companies using like the Pinkertons at Ludlow and Homestead, especially in anti-labor, you know, disputes and actually massacring people? Did that come up in your investigation?
You know, I did see it when I was reading up, when I was doing my research, but I didn't cover it in the book. But it is a very good example that these sorts of abuses are widespread and have been going on for a long time. And I'm always sort of intrigued when you get a company like Pinkerton's that has sort of a shady past, and yet, you know, now they're considered a respectable firm. I wanted to say one other thing about the U.S., too, because a lot of these abuses go unpunished when they happen abroad, because there's a big gap between national laws and the corporate reach of the corporation, the global reach of the corporations. But the U.S. actually, in that respect, at least has some laws that can reach further than the U.S. borders. A lot of countries like Canada, you know, they basically don't even try to get their laws to go beyond their borders. And I know there's a whole issue with extraterritoriality, and we don't want every government to sort of pass laws that cover the world. But at least in that one respect, you know, some of these companies that I looked at, like Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria and Talisman in Sudan, they're both facing lawsuits, and they're facing them in the U.S. because the U.S. was the only country that people could find where they could bring that sort of lawsuit.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Madeleine Drohan. She's a Canadian business journalist, author of the book Making a Killing, How Corporations Use Armed Force to Do Business. The book looks specifically at Africa and how this happens in Africa. But she also does note in the book that obviously that it happens elsewhere, and that she could certainly have written a book dealing with companies doing business in Latin America or in Asia or in the former Soviet Union. And perhaps that's a book for someone else to do. But this one specifically, at least the case studies that she writes about in this book are specifically drawn from Africa. The book is published by the Lions Press, was first published in Canada in 2003 and then here in the United States in 2004. And if you're interested in reading it, you can certainly go out and look for the book. Questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly within the last few years, we've seen some movement of consumers who are concerned about how the companies that that they might do business with or that they might purchase products from, they're concerned about how they treat their workers. Do you see that any kind of a movement that might address on that level, sort of on the consumer level, in a broad sort of a way, this kind of corporate conduct?
Well, it tends to be difficult for consumers if the company doesn't have a retail face, you know. Mm-hmm. For example, I mean, with Shell in Nigeria, they actually did face a boycott in 1995 after the Nigerian government killed an Ogoni protester, Ken Sarawiwa. And so consumers could say, this is awful. We want to show Shell that we don't support this, and we won't buy Shell gasoline. But if you're another company that isn't actually selling at the retail level, it's harder for consumers to actually go after them. However, shareholders can go after companies. And particularly now, the big institutional shareholders, the pension plans, they have a huge amount of clout. And I saw that with Talisman Energy when they were in Sudan, and there was a disinvestment campaign that was being carried out, including involving some of the big American pension funds as well, New York City and CalPERS. They were saying, look, we don't like the fact that you're involved there, and, you know, they were threatening to sell their shares, and in fact, they did sell their shares. And I noticed that there's been a bill that's just gone through the state senate in Illinois, you know, against companies buying shares in companies that are active in Sudan now. This is the type of thing that corporations do listen to. You know, when you get a hefty shareholder with a lot of clout saying, change what you're doing or we're out, then they do tend to listen. It's harder for individual shareholders to have that sort of clout with a company.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have a listener in Crete. They're next on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, Tarzan's alive and well living in Africa, but this white man's burden aspect, as you say, basically the customer can go to some gas station, but he doesn't know the problem of Africa, so he doesn't care. And if he knew it, he wouldn't care either. The shareholders want the bottom line. They're not concerned about the Ugandans in any way, shape, or form, except some religious fanatic perhaps might be. So basically what I'm saying is there's no check on this process. There's no way, any court in Hague or any place else, that takes a strong stand on this. They don't even take a strong stand in most of these killers who are presidents of these countries. So if the countries, by and large, have their own way with dictatorships and get away with it, with a few exceptions, then clearly the presidents of companies have even more free room to roam and do what they want. And I just wondered, since there is nothing to stop them, what policies would you like to see put in effect to try to check this madness?
Well, you brought up two very good points, and I just wanted to address them in order, because one thing we haven't talked about is sort of the inherent racism in all of this, is that part of the reason why there's not a huge outcry about a lot of these deaths at, you know, corporate hands or at mercenary hands is that these are deaths, the ones I looked at, in Africa, you know, and they're discounted as if they're not as important as if they happened in North America. And I did find that that was sort of a thread that went all the way through the book, that it's harder to get even the media interested in this. And plus, when corporations report who's died or, you know, they tend to report their employees and not anybody in the surrounding area. So that certainly plays into this. In terms about how to bring the corporations to account, that's harder because, as I was mentioning before, there's no comprehensive international law right now. There are bits and pieces. You know, the International Criminal Court that's just been set up, I know that the U.S. Doesn't support it, but other countries do, other governments do, and it is a place where corporate executives can be brought. You can't actually bring a corporation before the court, but you can bring a corporate executive there for human rights abuses. There's also, I think that the major industrialized countries, the governments, they know that this is a problem, and they've started to talk more about it. There is something called the Commission for Africa that the British Prime Minister Tony Blair set up, and we're going to be hearing a lot about that this summer because they're hosting the Group of Eight meeting. And they came out with a report saying, you know, it's just not good enough what we have, and we do have to at least write up, you know, firmer guidelines for these companies. Now, I have a problem with the guidelines because they're voluntary and there's no real sanction if a company doesn't actually follow their own guidelines. There might be some risk to their reputation, but there's no financial sanction. And I think that at the end of the day, there does need to be a law that covers this sort of activity by companies when they're away from home.
Well, I hope you can get on 60 Minutes or 2020 or Datelines that this information could be made available more to the general public. Good luck with that.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're down to having maybe about a minute or so left. Not long enough really for the question I want to ask, but I'm just also a little curious about what I understand is a project that you are working on now, have been for a little while, that is different but related, having to look at corporate corruption and whether there has been any kind of momentum behind trying to deal with corporate corruption, make corporations more responsible. And what we're talking about here is cases like Enron, for example.
Right. Well, I'm afraid when I proposed that research, I was a great deal more hopeful than when I ended it. I started that, I guess, in the spring of 2004. And what I was interested in is when there are scandals, how long does it take before sort of the impact of that scandal wears off? And in the case of Enron and WorldCom, it was interesting because the impact was so large at the beginning that, in fact, there was legislation put through almost immediately, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and that did curb some of the abuses, certainly not all of them. But if you're reading the papers these days, you're seeing more and more of the business leaders in the U.S. coming out and saying, it's gone too far, we have to change it, and it's just much too much regulation. So that scandal basically had an impact for less than 3 years, which I found a little bit disheartening. That said, I think the public, I always have a great deal of respect for the common sense of the public, and I think they have long memories and corporations are on notice now. So I don't think it'd be as easy to get away with it now as when it actually happened with Enron and WorldCom. So it's a bit of, you know, 50-50 answer for you.
Well, there we must leave it because we're here at the end of the time. If people who are listening want to read more on the subject we were talking about, how corporations use armed force to do business, they should look for the book, Making a Killing. It's published by the Lions Press by our guest, Madeline Drohan. She's an award-winning journalist. She's covered business and politics in Canada, in Europe, and Africa. And thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.